Hi, Jane, and hi, Lynn. Welcome to this conversational review of Nina Eidsheim's book, The Race of Sound. My name is Annelise. I'm going to open with a more general review of my thoughts on this book. In The Race of Sound, musicologist Nina Eidsheim aims to make the reader rethink the way they approach the naming of voice. Whenever one hears a voice, she argues, one automatically asks the acousmatic question, who is this? This question betrays the way we name a voice and understand it as an essentialized expression of a knowable individual. She perceives this activity of essentializing, especially in relation to vocal timbre, a concept that she understands very broadly as encompassing all characteristics that allow us to distinguish between two sounds of the same pitch and loudness. It is important to realize, according to Eidsheim, that equating timbre with specific essences is an act of interpretation on part of the listener, rooted in collective and cultural assumptions. Thus, she seeks to dispel the common notions that voice is one, singular, two, innate, and three, that its source is the singer. Instead, she puts the listener in the limelight. It is important to note that vocalists themselves also fall under the denominator of listeners. After all, vocalists listen to their own vocal production and interpret and adjust their production based on their own and others' cultural and collective perceptions about voice in general and theirs in particular. Throughout the chapters of the book, Eidsheim deconstructs how and why listeners read voices as a reflection of essence, with a particular attention to race, often in the intersection with gender. She discusses how hearing timbre as racial leads to constructions of imaginary identities that often deny singers agency. In chapter 2, for instance, she proposes the concept of a phantom genealogy, in which the voices of 19th and 20th century Black opera singers were framed within a minstrelsy performance culture. Discussing Billie Holiday in chapter 5, she highlights how her voice is interpreted as autobiographical, channeling ancestral history, and biologically determined. All ways of interpreting that suggest Holiday's sound came naturally and that keep us from understanding Holiday's artistic skills in crafting her own sound. A theme that also regularly comes back is how listeners expect that a voice's timbre corresponds to its visual bodily representation. If this is not the case, representations will be adjusted to fit the vocal timbre. In chapter 4, she demonstrates how this is even true of voice simulation technology, such as the Vocaloid. Ultimately, Eidsheim proposes to shift our attention to the elements of entrainment, style, and technique, as an approach that puts the singer's artistry in creating their sound center stage. Yet even in describing voice in these terms, Eidsheim warns against essentializing and champions the restoration of what she calls the multiplicity of the thick event. In other words, a description is only one among multiple options for giving meaning to the voice. There is an infinity of options that do not exclude one another, but add to the thickness of the description. Highlighting only one or a few options creates a hierarchy revealing the micropolitics of listening, a micropolitics that has disadvantaged Black vocalists. Eidsheim's approach seeks to reveal the ideological discourses that underpin our conceptions of voice. In this respect, she wears her activist hands, namely to counteract racist listening activities, openly on her sleeve. This stance may be in part the reason behind the book's availability as an open access publication from the University of California, which enables it to move easily beyond academia and reach wider audiences. Still, her relatively limited interest in understanding the reasons behind such racist listening practices left me as a reader hungry for more information, interpretation, and nuance on the historical case studies, and especially for more space dedicated to the singers' own discussions of their vocal production. Still, the silence fits her larger design. For paralleling Derrida's notion that there is no outside text, she posits that voice itself is not knowable beyond experiencing it as a vibrational event. Descriptions of voice only reveal something about the meaning construction activities of a particular listener at a particular time. Any description or interpretation is fragmentary and reveals listening's micropolitics. Ultimately, it is fitting that she ends the book with a quote by the poet Rumi, who, after exhorting the reader to free himself or herself from the prison of ideological bias, to, quote, live in silence. Such a proposal is nonetheless a bleak prospect for academia and its fondness of discursive discussion and interpretation. Still, the multitude of concepts Eitheim offers us to analyze how we listen provides a fertile field for further explorations in a multitude of fields, from musicology to African-American studies, from scientific considerations of voice to cultural and political ones. So Lynn, do you want to give your considerations on the book?
Sure. Thanks, Annalise. Hi, I'm Lynn. So about once every year, the Episcopal Church I attended in Connecticut hosted a special Sunday service where the choir featured several guest singers. As a member of the choir from the age of 8 to about 14, I remember these Sundays very vividly. One guest singer, an African-American man, was regularly invited to sing African-American spirituals. Getting to hear spirituals in place of our typical repertoire of Anglican hymns was very popular with our multiracial, multi-ethnic congregation. And I believe that for many, the visual representation of this African-American guest singer paired with music of the African-American tradition reified several themes Eitheim picks up on in The Race of Sound: the idea of an essential voice, timbral blackness, and timbral masculinity. For myself, however, an Eritrean American trained in the Western classical music tradition, who's also familiar with Southern Black Baptist musical practices, I understood the voice, the Black voice in particular, to be anything but essential. Despite my own cultural upbringing, particular instances such as these special Sundays and others have prompted me to ask similar questions to those raised by Eitheim. What do we name when we name voice in general and vocal timbre specifically? Through what associative network are African American singers' vocal timbres addressed? I found Eitheim's continued exploration of the phantom genealogy in chapter 3 as it pertains to timbral ambiguity of jazz vocalist Jimmy Scott to be endlessly compelling. Arguing that falsetto allowed African-American male performers of the mid-20th century to maintain a sense of masculinity or even hyper-masculinity in the popular imagination, Eitheim brings to the fore our own listening biases around gender, pitch, and timbre. There was one major consideration, though, that I had hoped she might have addressed. Smokey Robinson, Stevie Wonder, Marvin Gaye, Sam Cooke, the Temptations, and others referred to as Scott's colleagues or contemporaries were coming out of the Motown, gospel, blues, pop, and R&B musical spheres. They were not necessarily jazz vocalists as Scott came to be. As such, I wonder what a comparison between Scott and other contemporary male artists specific to the jazz vocal world, like a Billy Eckstein, might reveal. How do we read a voice like Scott's within a uniquely jazz context? In bringing together these performers from across music genres and also across racial lines, she includes Frankie Valli in the Four Seasons, Eitheim opens the door to future conversations, allowing us to elaborate on her question, how is gender signaled vocally? By asking, how is gender signaled vocally across genres? And what are our expectations as listeners when it comes to hearing style and technique as they relate to gender and genre? In her final chapter, Widening Rings of Being, after challenging the listener to reimagine their understanding of and position to the voice and the vocalizer, Eitheim offers her antidote to issues that have been percolating throughout the book, such as how do we unlearn how we listen? How do we develop analytical tools that don't replicate essentialisms? Through what Eitheim calls the pause, she suggests that we might take time to acknowledge our own place as listeners and practice intentional self-aware listening. In doing so, the answer to the acousmatic question, who is this, could now be one of many in a chain of potentialities. What is exciting about the pause is that we begin to move away from the cult of fidelity and towards hearing the voice of style and technique. In this sense, we as listeners may recognize a sense of agency and artistry on behalf of the vocalizer and free ourselves from the assumptions that voice is innate, singular, or that its voice is the singer. In short, we can start to assume our own role as active agents. On the other hand, I'm cautious of the complete departure or, quote, turn away from identification that Edgecombe anticipates may result from refiguring processes of listening. In The Race of Sound, Edgecombe contributes to the growing collection of scholarship on the intersection of orality, race, and history. The interdisciplinary range present in this work, which crosses disciplinary boundaries in different critical modes, should appeal to scholars and students of musicology, sound and performance studies, as well as American and African American cultural studies.
Thank you very much, Lynn, for this enlightening review of some of the important concepts. Jane, would you like to add your voice to the mixture?
Thanks, Annalise, and thanks, Lynn. I'll just give my response now. There is only one element of music for which I've never yet devised a successful gimmick or satisfactory method of explanation when teaching my first two fundamentals of music sessions of the semester for non-music major undergraduates, and that's timbre. I cycle through several of the themes that Edgecombe brings up, but the class never quite gets to grip with timbre's elusiveness. And when it comes to the voice in the context of Edgecombe's terminology of thick and thin sound events, it seems that the situation multiplies a hundredfold in complexity. Each case study's deconstruction of timbre is fascinating, but it is Edgecombe's exhortations, sometimes written, sometimes implied, to her readers to listen to listening that has stuck most vividly with me. The great value I take away here is more a framework and a set of tools emerging from her case studies than what is being added to the literature on any of the individuals discussed, though it's without doubt welcome. The question rephrased and restated throughout the book, what do we name when we name voice, forces a great deal of introspection. As a white English scholar and a classically trained singer who also writes about race, opera and vocal music, I find Edgecombe's methodology especially productive, not because she is doing the work for me, but because she makes it clear just how much work I should be doing. Perhaps my only mild frustration was when a huge important topic leapt out from the page, but was not probed explicitly for where it might lead. I found, for instance, that the brilliant notion of the phantom genealogy of timbre brought up interlocking realms of memory, history, and heritage, but discussion of their potential wider significance seemed to stop short. And one aspect I wanted to hear more of throughout was the presence and or agency of African Americans in the discourses that Edgecombe interrogates. So considerable portions of the case studies are given to audience and listener readings and hearings of Black voices, but being drawn primarily from white discourses offered a slightly one-dimensional understanding. Establishing the oral practices of white listeners over about two centuries perhaps inevitably reflects archival imbalances. Yet while it's immensely valuable research, I wanted to hear about the perceptions of other actors in this history. As we hear how Jimmy Scott, for instance, resisted the projections of his listeners, are there other narratives to add to this of listeners resisting, indirectly, other listeners' projections? And once social media enters in chapter four, we glimpses of resistance and backlash appear. Sometimes I could have heard more from both from Edgecombe herself as a listener. I found her discussion of her own journey in the concluding parts of the book to be powerful, as well as from performers discussed. The fetishization of Holiday's voice, for instance, was clear, but I found the lack of Holiday's own perspectives to be a pressing absence. And I wondered what differentiation there might be among oral behaviours when considering the, quote, central role played by audiences in the production of voices. So this brings me to a final point, which is the question of whiteness, a concept never quite named, though very much always present. In chapter five, we return to a key point that the, quote, timbral identification of race is not a result of racist views. And while so much of the discourse that Edgecombe examines is demonstrably racist, I do find her argument compelling that those behaviours stem more from fundamental misconceptions about sound, voice and listening, that it goes even deeper than systemic white supremacy. But the questions I'm left with are, do white listeners only racialize timbre when they are attending to perceived non-whiteness? Do white listeners pay attention to whiteness in sound? My concluding point here is far from that we need to hear more about white people in a book about African-American vocal music, but there are enormous questions emerging from this text for future scholars writing in a similar vein. The occasions when I wanted more from the text are not necessarily gaps in Edgecombe's investigations. That each chapter offers such a conceptual multitude shows a way, perhaps, to push ourselves in multiple directions. And I find the inherently transdisciplinary mode of her inquiry to be a potentially powerful model for the future of voice studies. Nothing here is the last word, but a map and a set of strategies for retraining, for paying attention to how we are listening as everyday listeners in the world as much as scholars. What it asks us to examine when we make the move to name voice is a necessary and difficult challenge. Our task is to scrutinize not only what we think we know, but why we even think to know it, and proceed from there.
Thank you very much, Jean, for that also very enlightening discussion. Herewith, I open a spontaneous discussion amongst the three of us. I think what I find interesting coming out of the responses is this idea of, well, both identity. So what do we do with voice and identity? Lynn, you mentioned that maybe you don't want to throw away identity completely. But I think also both of your responses interacted with this idea of like blackness and whiteness maybe not being as monolithic as she sometimes posits it.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, Annalise, on that point. I think that, as Jane had mentioned, the type of case studies that she draws from does give the reader that impression that blackness and the black voice was thought of as X, and we only kind of got these selective, somewhat demeaning and derogatory accounts of how white listeners responded to and perceived the black voice, singular. And I think that the control group, so to speak, that it's been used to as a measure for determining and describing the black voice is, as Jane again mentioned, is very much one-sided. I'm curious to know what was being said about performers like Anderson, Holiday Scott, and others in African-American archival resources like Ebony and Jet Magazine and many others. What were the reflections or reactions of black listeners, black critics, and the performers themselves? Because I think in that sense, we would have gotten a much wider and much more comprehensive understanding of the black voice rather than just from the side of white listeners, white critics from the 20th century.
Yeah, it's an interesting question because, you know, especially in the chapter on Anderson, when she's in the 19th century and going back over other opera singers that are sort of predecessors to Anderson, it strikes me that it's probably quite difficult to get to the kind of sources that we're after. It's not impossible, but I kind of wanted to know, is it out there and it's just super hard to find? Is it there was sort of a lack of explicit saying, like, these are the sources I'm using, here are the issues with them and here are the problems, but here's why I'm specifically focusing on this. And we kind of got this sort of, as people said, the monolithic, the listener this, the listener that, or the audiences. And it was kind of always clear that we're only really thinking about white audiences listening to black and to African American voices, but it's never sort of named as such. So it was an interesting sort of like omission or something that's kind of bubbling under the surface, but you're not quite sure where to go with it.
Yeah, and I think it's only really in the chapter on the Vocaloids, the chapter 4, where she also goes into contemporary, or at least more or less contemporary, technologies of voice simulation, that she starts thinking about blackness also not just as one monolithic thing, but also there really discusses the heritage and the possibly more complicated heritage of the singers that are represented and how that interacts with how white audience members then potentially are also taking a little bit more of a resistance and an activist stance, as you also mentioned in your review, Jane. That it's there where the resistance of the singers themselves and even the audience against what she posits as a very one-way street of listening, where that starts to come to the surface.
Yeah, and actually, you know, one thing that you do get in the chapter on Anderson is a lot more perspective, I think, from singers and other people firsthand, ironically, in a way, from the sort of opera singers today that we hear from. So, and that's, I think, I mean, I know from my own research that there is quite a big body of sources, not as big as we'd hope it to be, but of the perspectives of African-American opera singers both today and throughout the 20th century. And that's out there. And I feel like that actually came through quite strongly, but maybe it's because it was about opera and there's a kind of more familiarity or more availability or something that we got those perspectives of people today and we really understood a lot from them, but less so from the actual people in the discourses, if that makes sense. So from the people that she's sort of examining both historically and in Anderson's time, we get less from them, but we get a lot from the sort of present day. And there was a kind of way it sort of neatly dovetailed, I think, with a lot of very pressing current discussions about opera and race in America today that it sort of was pointing towards. But it was a little like that was coming on the heels of the historical side. So I don't know.
I found chapter two, chapter on Marian Anderson and Phantom Genealogy, and I think this is what you're both saying to a certain degree, that of course we wanted to hear a lot more from the artists themselves. I felt like they, in kind of an ironic boomerang type way, is not giving them voice, is not giving them agency, and often describes them as being put in roles or being plugged into the standard repertoire's liminal roles, kind of rendering them powerless and in a passive position. But I found that with divas, operatic divas like Leontine Price, who specifically kind of actively chose to sing roles like Aida in, for example, her farewell to opera, because she found that, you know, Aida is not a slave, she's a captive princess. Like, she chose to play that role. She was not put into a liminal role to play a liminal character.
Yeah, in that respect, I've also been thinking about the case of Billie Holiday, of which there is actually quite a lot of material available that could throw more light on how she used specific elements, even from the way that people read her, to get commercial success. And also, I mean, she has at least been identified as a big activist herself with regard to racial issues in the 60s. And some of that, I feel, is just missing also from that chapter. The way that she portrays her doesn't necessarily seem to allow the more artistic but also activist nature of some of these singers themselves to shine through, and thus could offer like productive ways forward that do not like victimize necessarily all Black singers.
Yeah, I mean, that also gets to something that I feel like, Annalise, you brought up a little bit when you mentioned sort of hungry for more, especially of interpretation and sort of from the historical lens. It's something that's interesting when we're talking about that intersection of biography and analysis and listening and all of these things. And Lynn, as you said, you know, I'm also very cautious of this idea of moving away from identification, whatever that might imply. And I think an interesting thing to consider for when we're writing about people who are no longer here and we can't access them in the moment and talk to them and interview them, you know, what are we doing as scholars writing about them? How are we sort of, are we in trying to sort of elevate their agency? In what ways are we sort of reproducing some of the historical oppressions against them and so on? And this is something that, you know, in other circles has come up a lot, talking about sort of bringing up so-called forgotten composers or artists from the past, you know, whether women or composers of color. And, you know, yeah, it's an interesting question, I think, as historians, as well as looking in a much more broad sense about just like ideas of voice and listening in general. And in the last section of the book, she brings up this kind of like what singers need to be doing, this sort of vocal critical performance practice methodology. And I was kind of curious what were your impressions of what she expects of like modern day singers to bring to their practice.
What I find really revealing about her way of talking about classical singers is kind of the way that we are trained to listen to ourselves, to dovetail this idea that while we are very much trained to sound a certain way, there is all this discourse in singing pedagogy about how you're supposed to free your own voice. Mm-hmm. And I think in a way, some of the ways that Eidsheim's
way of talking opens new perspectives is, I think, also in the way that you suggested, Lynn, is by also thinking about genre and gender in relation to style and technique. Because at least in opera singing or in certain environments, there is this idea that, like, oh, only this specific technique of singing is the one that actually frees your voice, is the one that is the healthy one for singing. And I think it kind of reveals a lot of this essentialism that also is there in music education and in voice education. But certain genres have very specific techniques for singing, or also entrainment for interpreting, for using technique, for using style. And I think that was actually also quite interesting how you identified, Lynn, that as a kind of missed opportunity with the chapter on jazz, that it could have been an opening to think more about a genre in respect to these ideas of voice and style and technique.
And to add to that specifically, what audiences expect from certain genres in terms of style and technique, because, I mean, we move away in chapter three from dealing with audiences who might listen to a Verdi or Wagner opera to those who are listening to pop and jazz. And clearly their assumptions or understanding of what they're hearing, again, from a technical or stylistic point of view, is going to be very different. And it seems to be, you know, getting into kind of complicated, dangerous territory here when you're mixing jazz or talking about jazz repertoire alongside artists who are clearly in the pop or blues or gospel, as she even brings up, spheres.
I think in general, genre, or the idea of genre in this, is something that maybe is a lot more complicated and multidimensional than it sometimes comes across. In chapter one and two, where she's talking a lot more about opera, it struck me that there was often a kind of slippage between the classical voice and the operatic voice. And, you know, it sounds really pedantic and nitpicky, but actually I think there's a really big difference between the operatic voice and other kind of classical voices that isn't quite sort of navigated. And what's interesting in that is that there are singers who, many singers, including the ones like Marian Anderson that we're talking about, they straddle all of those. And so singing, you know, and it comes up when we talk about the singing of Schubert and, you know, Lieder, and for example, but that, if you think of audiences, classical audiences, expectations of, say, a Lieder recital versus a operatic performance, and even within opera you have early whatever, but let's not go down that road. But then what's happening when one singer is sort of moving between those? So I think in general, a room for sort of differentiation and sort of perhaps shoring up or pointing up how those sort of bigger questions of genre might be theorized as we go through the sort of practices she's trying to encourage us to do as listeners.
Well, maybe just as a final thing to bring up in this discussion is, I find it rather interesting how she was very open about not only her own experiences, but the more activist stance that this book is taking, and that she is very clearly saying, part of what I'm trying to do is to make ourselves listen to how racist ideologies might have crept into the way that we listen and that we construct voice. It's also, I thought, in that respect, interesting that it's available as an open access book, and thus slightly easier accessible for people outside of academia, at least, as long as they're also able to know about it. So I just wanted to hear both of your opinions.
I'd say for me, there's, as I said in my response, I think it leaves, so the things that we are sort of finding that need more pushing, or a sort of areas that we wanted more nuance and exploration. I think what's great about that is that I feel like it offers a huge amount for anyone reading this to go forward in their own research. I feel like everything that is left out or sort of not is, or is a bit too one-dimensional, isn't like, well, that's just a bit frustrating, we move on. I think it's, you know, and perhaps I'm biased because it's close to my own area, but I think it is, and especially of how she makes interventions in so many different disciplinary fields, I think it has great, great potential to spawn a huge amount of more work in this vein. And in that sense, that sort of activist stance, as we're calling it, really does prove productive. But I was struck by, I hadn't really thought about what you brought up, Annalise, about the access to non-academic audiences. And I don't know. I mean, I think that in terms of access, in terms of economics, that's probably true. But I find it very difficult to believe that even if non-academic audiences who are interested in this knew about the book, that they would actually be able to get to grips with it in a way that would be productive. I mean, this is, you know, it's quite close to a lot of things we're thinking about. And I'm sure, you know, there are things I struggled with that I have to read several times. I think it's not accessible to a non-academic audience as a piece of writing. I think the ideas there are 100% accessible and extremely interesting. And, you know, I mentioned this to you both in an email, but just as I was preparing for this, I was explaining it to my parents over dinner, and they're both very musical, but very much not academics. And it took a while, but once they sort of understood the general thrust of it, they were so interested. And it immediately got down to questions of like biology and nature versus nurture and evolution and all of these sorts of topics. And it was so interesting to hear. And I feel like there is actually a huge potential to reach non-academic audiences. But I see a huge barrier for that actually happening without some sort of mediation, translation, as it were. I don't know.
No, I agree with you, Jane. I think that there are some chapters in the book that are a bit more accessible than others. I think, you know, chapter one, the introduction in chapter one are really fantastic. But in a similar sense, I was talking to my grandmother about chapter three and Jimmy Scott and a lot of the artists who are mentioned there around, you know, her time period in like Motown and, you know, early jazz. And the conversation was really interesting. She was very engaged and interested in the points that I mentioned that Etienne brings up.
So yes, it opens a lot of questions and a lot of messages that can be quite widely distributed. And she has also been going around the US and giving a lot of talks, which I think is part of this mm-hmm. activity of translating it to wider audiences. But I think I agree with both of you in that both the way that the book is written is definitely in an academic tone and really interacting with academic theories that we scholars care about. But also I think some of the listening practices, some of the elements she mentions are discernible by people who are really used to listening to voices and know about certain techniques and styles and maybe even genres that are very well trained at hearing the nuances.
What I think is very accessible is just how much it gets to like things that fundamentally affect us in our everyday lives. If you take away the sort of interventions in voice studies or opera or history, anything like that, any of the sort of more sort of finely honed academic bits, and we get to, you know, the central thrust of what are you doing? You know, I think we both quoted this in our responses. What are we doing when we try to name voice? How do we listen to listening? Voice not being essence and the source of the voice being within the listener. That I think those are three sort of pretty neat concepts that I think we can just bring that into our everyday lives. And, you know, I've already noticed like different ways that I'm doing things as a listener, but not to do with like my scholarship or anything like that, but just like when I listen to the radio or listen to music, I think my parents are going to maybe think about it. You know, I don't know. I think there's ways that can be, we can sort of distill some of this in a way that actually is so applicable, just how do we relate to each other as humans. And this is kind of what she gets at when she's like, this isn't just about racism. It's easy just to say how they do, you know, audience X responds is racist and it reflects this. But she's like, okay, let's go beyond that and think about how we relate to sound as humans. And I think there's a lot to go with there.
And as she mentioned, it puts us in a bit of an uncomfortable situation for a moment. You know, we expect that we can know voice or that we can determine and, you know, point specifically at, I know that this is this person, or I know that I'm hearing this. And so to relinquish ourselves of that power and knowledge can be a bit you know, unsettling and a bit uncomfortable, but I think it's an activity exercise that is will only be bettering for us in the future.
Yes, I would definitely agree with both of your assessments, and it has made me think about voices a lot more in detail and what I'm doing when I'm listening to them. So thank you very much for this conversational review, and let's continue the discussion.